Despite many provisions, there was large-scale evasion of the law. The peasants, for fear of ejection and because of party and lack of organization, did not approach courts or sought redress at the political level. Another weakness relates to the heavy compensation at around Rs. 670 crores paid to the ex-intermediaries. Apart from the drain on budgetary resources of the states, its use by recipients has been anti-growth. Instead of being used as investment funds, it was by and large wasted on conspicuous consumption. The net benefit to the states by way of increase in land revenue was comparatively small. Apart from the cultivators in the areas under the zamindari system who suffered, those in other areas are no better off. In fact, they are worse off because of the many inadequacies of the laws and failures in their implementation. These shortcomings are described as under. First one, in the first place, the problem was solved by only fixing rents and not by reducing them. For example, in many places, rents were fixed at levels equivalent to current prevailing rates or traditionally fixed rates. No attempt was made to reduce these rents. It only means that cultivators cannot now pay less than the rates thus fixed. In respect of a number of laws, there are many exemptions and escape clauses which have been misused against the interest of cultivators. For example, in these laws, provisions have been made for the resumption of land for self-cultivation by landowners. But the definition of self-cultivation is so loosely worded that many landowners have resumed a substantial part of the land. They do not cultivate such lands themselves, but give them to others for cultivation on the basis of sharecropping. These sharecroppers work on oral and informal leases and are always under the threat of ejection. For these poor and weak cultivators, there is thus no protection under the tenancy laws. The third shortcoming is, there are no doubt restrictions on the ejection of tenants, but these have been largely evaded by landowners. Besides, there was large-scale ejectment through the device of voluntary surrenders, that is, fictitious surrender wherein tenant cultivators on their own accord give up their right on land, which in reality is largely under fear of ejectment. The fourth shortcoming is, the facilities to enable cultivators to become owners were neither such that they could easily become owners, nor were they implemented in letter and spirit by the states. The Task Force on Agrarian Relations was of the opinion that these laws were such that cultivators who plow land, sow seeds, harvest crops and do other agricultural activities could not become owners of land. The committee was also of the opinion that perhaps such a law that would enable only the actual tiller of the land to become owner might not be possible to enact. Were such an act to put on the state, the committee thought that in the existing conditions it could not be implemented. The fifth shortcoming is, the tenancy reform laws have not been fully implemented. Many officials themselves or their relatives or friends were owners of land. As a result, the laws meant for the benefit of cultivators were not fully implemented. Poor cultivators have neither the resources nor the information about the legal procedures to go to courts. Those who did were not fully satisfied. The lack of adequate records largely stood in the way of courts to do justice to these cultivators. On the whole, therefore, there has been only a little gain for the tenant cultivators. Suggested measures. To improve upon the conditions of tenant cultivators, there is a need to make further moves on the following lines. There is the need for further improvements in the state of affairs in areas where zamindari system has been abolished. For example, some remnants of intermediary tenures, such as religious and charitable inams, which still exist, remain to be abolished. There is again the urgency for checkmating the emerging absentee landlordism, which is rack-renting poor cultivators. It is also desirable that the rights of the tenants in these areas are brought on a uniform basis. The assessments in respect of amounts payable by tenants to the erstwhile zamindars also need to be put on a rational basis. The second measure is more stringent restrictions be imposed on the resumption of land for personal cultivation by landowners. The Task Force on Agrarian Relations has suggested that it should be ensured that either the landowner resuming land or his near relative should supervise the land resumed for cultivation and that he should reside near his land in the village. But this suggestion is not likely to cut much ice. The landowner will succeed in getting over the requirement of the law by keeping a residence in the village only on paper. Such a provision will in effect perpetuate absentee landlordism and the associated evil of ejectment. The only effective solution lies in permitting resumption of land by the owner for personal cultivation only on the condition that he himself cultivates it. The third measure is, in states where tenancy laws exist, more effective steps need to be taken to provide support to the cultivators. One such step is to ease the conditions of transfer of ownership of land to the tenant cultivator. 2. There should be quick surveys for recording or registration of tenants to ensure proper legal basis for the rights of tenants and sharecroppers. 3. There is need to undertake measures to prevent or curb the re-emergence of informal tenancy. This is of particular importance in tribal areas to protect the alienation of their lands to non-tribals or to big landowners. The fourth measure would be, there are some states which have not as yet undertaken measures for securing the rights of tenants, the regulation of rent. It was expected that by 1981 and 82, all states would have enacted laws to confer ownership rights on the tenants, but this has not been the case so far. It is therefore necessary that such enactments are expedited. An important requirement for keeping the reformed agrarian relations on a sound basis is to compile records of land periodically, update the same in step with the legislative measures and their implementation. The records contain valuable information in respect of ownership of land, the rights of tenants and the sharecroppers, etc. The land records also needs to be prepared for the unrecorded lands. All this information is useful for determining surpluses of land, distribution of the surplus among the tenants, for avoidance or resolving of disputes, for facilitating the administration of justice and for drafting unambiguous laws, etc. At the end, it may be pointed out that no program of land reforms can be successfully carried out without the mass awakening among cultivators themselves. The political organization of the poor peasantry can alone force the pace and shape of land reforms. The government can make officials act as per the requirements of the law, and records can be prepared smoothly if only the whole affair is done in collaboration with political agencies.
Next, we'll come to redistribution of the land. An important constituent of land reforms aims at changes in the land size one can own. It involves a reduction in the size of the land of big landowners. The surplus land thus made available is transferred to the small farmers. This means a redistributive justice. Equally importantly, it is to raise agricultural production and incomes of the small farmers. The main features are, under this piece of land reforms, a ceiling is fixed on a maximum size of land that a landlord can own. The land over a ceiling is declared surplus. This surplus is acquired by the government on payment of price. The surplus land is then distributed among the farmers with small sized lands or no lands on payment. Of course, the small farmers' lands thus increased are not to exceed the limit set by the ceiling. The main elements and the achievements in respect of this type of land reform may be described as under. The policy of ceiling on the size of the land one can own was laid down by the central government in 1972. In terms of this policy, guidelines were sent to the state governments to formulate laws for their states. The provisions in these laws may be spelt out in terms of the following three elements. 1. The basis of fixation of ceiling is the family. The family is defined as consisting of husband, wife and children. For families with more than 5 children, there is provision for holding land in excess of the ceiling for every additional member. But this is subject to the condition that at no time does the total land with a family exceed twice the ceiling limit for the family. 2. The maximum that a family can own has been fixed keeping in view the various factors bearing on the cultivation of the land. For land which have an assured supply of water and where at least 2 crops are raised, the ceiling, depending upon the productivity of land and other factors, has been fixed at 10 to 18 acres. In places where irrigation is done by private sources for purposes of fixation of ceiling, 1.25 acres is deemed to be equivalent to 1 acre of land irrigated by public sources. But this is subject to the condition that in both cases, the upper limit does not exceed 18 acres. In areas where there is provision of irrigation for the raising of only one crop, the upper limit of the ceiling has been fixed at 27 acres. For the remaining types of land, the upper limit set is 54 acres. In places where there is the possibility of irrigation by tube wells, states have been permitted to fix the lower ceiling. In respect of sandy areas and mountainous regions, the upper limit can exceed even 54 crores. For those owners who have different types of land, their lands for purposes of ceiling, they are to be converted into the land of minimum categories, and the upper limit for holding land in such cases is not to exceed 54 acres. 3. The various laws of the states also provide for exemptions in respect of certain categories of land. There are, for example, grazing lands, cooperative farms, lands under religious trust, etc. The next point is need and justification. We now take up the basic question concerning the need and justification of the policy of ceiling on land ownership. We shall briefly summarize the stand of those who support it and those who oppose it, before we make a final assessment of the case for and against the ceiling policy. Case for ceiling. The supporters of the policy of ceiling argue on the basis of both social justice and economic development. From the egalitarian standpoint, they refer to the existing vast inequalities in the distribution of land ownership. It is a fact that while a very small minority holds vast area of land, an overwhelming majority has to do with a very small proportion. For example, according to the 48th round of National Sample Survey in 1992, about 72% of rural households own around 1 hectare of land, and these households together own only about 17% of the total land. As against this 1% of the rural households who own 10 hectares or above have in their possession 14% of agricultural land. Because of this inequality, a few in the villages are very rich while the vast majority live in poverty. So far as the development argument is concerned, it is pointed out that ceiling policy will lead to the emergence of small peasant class. The owner cultivator will work with enthusiasm, give his best to the land and take the maximum out of it. It is argued that small peasant farming emergently suits India's labor surplus economy. By and large, these farmers will be using family labor and therefore will not be deterred by the market wage rate in employing workers. They will be, in fact, carry the application of labor to the point of zero marginal productivity. This will at once result in two beneficial consequences: largest possible employment and maximum possible production. It is pointed out that productivity per hectare of small farms in many countries is larger than that of large farms. Allied to the second argument, it is also pointed out that a policy of ceiling can be used to promote cooperative farming, as also inculcate the spirit of cooperation in other areas of agriculture. Surplus land can be distributed on the condition that the beneficiaries form themselves into cooperatives. Being landless agriculturists and small farmers, they can be so organized in cooperatives that they employ labor as a family farmer would do. In this way, while the disadvantage of very small farming can be got over, the advantage of big farming can be realized. It is further pointed out that the emergence of small farmers and their cooperatives can be a bulwark against the evils of old zamindari system. Absentee landlordism, which has raised its ugly head in the wake of zamindari abolition, can be dealt with effectively only by promoting small individual farmers and their cooperatives. Now we'll see case against the ceiling. There are some who do not support the policy of ceiling on landholdings. While they concede the egalitarian aspect of the policy, they do not attach much importance to it. The reason given is that the most urgent problem before the country is that of development, and from this angle, according to them, a policy of ceiling makes little worthwhile contribution. In support of this, they advance several arguments. The first one is, one argument is that since land is given by nature and is scarce in relation to our needs, it is no use distributing it. It is pointed out that however low may be the limit of ceiling, everyone in the village cannot be provided with a reasonable piece of land. So why do it? In fact, the correctness of the logic lies in the other way round. Since land is scarce, it is all the more reasonable that it should be rationed and distributed among as many as possible, subject to the condition that it is not less than what is required for efficient farming. Or in case of very small farmers, this is given on the condition that these farmers form themselves into cooperative to pool their land. The second point is, it is also said that small cultivators do not have adequate resources to make any investment in land. This, the argument proceeds, will affect adversely agricultural production. But as against this, it can be asked as to whether the big owners ever care to make adequate investment in land. Had they done so, the productivity of land could not have been as low as it is now. In this connection, it needs also to be emphasized that the policy of distribution of surplus land should not be viewed in isolation from the general strategy of economic development of the country. When such a policy is pursued, it is in consonance with the general objectives of planning in India. As such, small farmers have to be viewed as producing units which are to be given every help to make them viable. In any case, the mere fact that these farmers will work with enthusiasm and employ more labor should lead to more production. Moreover, it needs to be emphasized that in respect of many agricultural activities, it is the investment in terms of labor that is more important, and this the small farmers possess in plenty. The third point is, another argument advanced is that a policy of ceiling will lead to the breakup of big farms and will therefore involve the loss of advantages of large-scale farming, resulting in lowering of production and rising of costs. But this argument is fallacious on two counts. In the first place, in decrease, although implicitly, that ownership of small farms is synonymous with small operational farms. And secondly, that small farms are not operationally a sound economic proportion. Both these arguments are unsolved. It is true that under a policy of ceiling and redistribution of surplus land, there will emerge a large number of small farms. But one should bear in mind the distinction between the unit of ownership of land and the unit of cultivation. If the farmer is small, it does not follow necessarily that the latter will also be small. Owners of small farms can pool their land for purposes of cultivation or can take land on lease from others. They can thus reap the benefits of large-scale farming. To say that ownership of small farms implies small farming seems a specious argument. More important, however, is the second implication of the argument, namely that small farming is economically unsound. The fact of matter, however, is contrary to what the argument contends. It has been established that advantages of large-scale operations in agriculture are limited. The experience of several countries shows that the per hectare output in small farms is larger than in big farms. Take for example Japan, where farms are small in size. About 94% of farms are less than 2 hectares, and as much as 77% of the total land is under these small farms. But the average output of these farms is very high. The average production of rice per hectare is over 6,300 kg, whereas in USA, where the average size of farm is 123 hectares, the average production per hectare is over 5,500 kg. In the same way, there is small farming in Taiwan. The upper limit of farms in Taiwan is 2.8 hectares and the techniques of production are highly labor intensive. Here too, production of land is very high. In India also, farm management surveys have established the fact that big farms are not superior to small farms. Generally, it has been observed that productivity in big farms is less than the small ones, and as the size of the farm increases, the productivity of the land decreases. The reason for higher productivity in respect of small farms is obvious. In such farms, it is family labor and not wage labor that is employed. Now the family labor is employed till the point where marginal productivity, that is additional production due to the additional labor, falls to zero. This means that production is maximized because the use of labor is carried to the point where no more additions can be made to the total volume of production. As against this, in big capitalist farms, labor, since it is to be employed on wages, will be engaged only up to the point where marginal productivity becomes equal to the wage rate. This means that the land, if worked beyond this level of marginal productivity equal to the wages, can add more to total production. Since the logic of large-scale farming does not permit it, land will not be worked beyond this point. Hence, productivity of land on small farms is higher.
Fourth point is, in this connection, doubts are also raised with regard to the capacity of small farms to make adequate saving and part with a reasonable proportion of production in the form of marketable surplus. It is argued that small farmers consume a large proportion of their incomes and that the marginal propensity to consume is higher in the case of poor people. Therefore, it is difficult for them to save any reasonable amount and equally difficult to sell a large proportion in the market. The argument has some strength, at least theoretically. In practice, however, it may not happen. For example, if it is presumed that small farming will result in large production, there is no reason why there should not be larger savings and larger surpluses. The collection of surpluses from numerous small and scattered farms will no doubt pose a big problem. But this is simply an organizational difficulty which can be got over, among others, through cooperatives at the farming stage or collecting and marketing at marketing stages. Fifth point is, it is also said that small farming will have an unfavorable impact on the supply of raw materials to industries. It is contended that small farmers will simply be concerned with the production of food for their own consumption. It is further stated that production of raw materials generally requires larger inputs which are not within the means of small farmers and are possible only on big farms. This argument, however, has little validity. It is for the simple reason that the crop pattern is not so much dependent upon the size of the farm as on natural conditions like type of soil, climate, etc. Within the broad limits set by nature, it is the profitability considerations that determine the pattern of crops. Sixth point is, yet another argument advanced against ceiling policy is that it is unfair to apply ceilings on land without at the same time limiting the size of other forms of property, that is, urban property. Such an argument only spotlights the need for reducing inequalities of wealth in other spheres also. This, however, does not by itself demolish the case for ceiling on land. It needs to be mentioned in this connection that agricultural land does not increase in quantity. As against this, other forms of wealth like houses, machines, etc., are such that their supplies can be increased. Therefore, in the case of land, it is the distribution of the existing but permanently fixed land that is involved. In other forms of property, this is not the case. While redistribution is important in the case of non-agricultural property, there is no similar urgency about it, since this type of wealth can be increased to meet the demand of the non-possessors. Unsatisfactory progress. While the policy of redistribution of land has been in operation since long, it has in its implementation been far from satisfactory. Little achievement. One indicator of the unsatisfactory performance is the small amount of land that has been acquired and a still smaller amount that has been distributed. As per the statistics, the surplus area so far distributed in 4.4 million acres. This is much less than that declared surplus at 7.6 million acres. The achievement thus lags behind by as much as 3.2 million acres. The failure also lies in acquiring the land that was declared surplus. The land so far acquired in 5.9 million acres. This is 1.7 million less than the declared surplus. Equally importantly, the failure lies in estimating the land that could be declared surplus. For example, as estimated by experts in 1970, the surplus land could be as much as 40 million acres. But in 1955, Mahalanobis put the figure of likely surplus at 60 million acres. Somewhat better program. While the working of the earlier policy has not been a satisfactory one, the present policy in operation since the early 70s has been an improved one over that of the old policy. This is obvious from the fact that the three elements of the program have been so changed that the new policy has become a lot more promising than the old policy which prevailed before 1972. One change envisages the unit of application to be a family rather than an individual as was the case before. This means a big reduction in the size of land that could be retained by a family. In other words, a large surplus can be made available. Secondly, the ceiling on the maximum land that could be retained by an owner or family was reduced considerably. This should mean an increase in the surplus land for distribution. Thirdly, the list of lands exempted from the ceiling laws in the old policy has also been drastically curtailed. For example, such large-sized units as mechanized farms, sugarcane farms or factories, lands under private trust, etc., exempt under the old policy, have been included in the new policy. All these changes should have resulted in a better performance on the part of the government. This is, as stated above, is however not the case. Causes of inadequate implementation. We have already said that the area of land declared surplus and that collected are small and that distributed still smaller. It is appropriate that we go into the causes of the inadequate implementation of this policy. The major factors responsible for the failure may be listed as under. First reason for failure is long delays and litigation. The time gap between the announcement of the policy and enactment of laws on one hand and implementation on the other has enabled owners to indulge in all sort of fictitious transfers and sale of land to get over the provisions of sealing laws. The new policy was first announced on 26 September 1970 in a meeting of the chief ministers, when the matter was entrusted to the Central Land Reforms Commission. It was after an interval of a few months on 24 January 1971 that the policy came to be applied. During this period, the big landlords, finding popular acceptance of the policy, made all kinds of deals to evade the law. Fake transfers in the name of relatives, friends and even their tenants were made to preempt the application of any sealing law. When the law actually came into being, its enforcement was further delayed by legal cases filed in the courts which ran into lakhs. In the process, quite a big chunk of the would-be surplus land was lost. Even at present, the land declared surplus is not wholly available for distribution. According to the 7th plan, as much as 1.6 million acres of distributable land is involved in litigation. Defective conception. The policy from the very beginning was not rightly conceived and defects continued even in the various laws enacted by the states. For example, the policy and the law related only to the ownership and not to the owner-cultivator. As a result, even the lands transferred legally to tenants were taken over by ex-owners on the basis of oral or written documents on a long-term basis. Besides, the laws provided for many exemptions, despite the fact that the list of exemptions was curtailed under the new policy. Moreover, considerable powers were given to states with regard to exemptions and related things. Largely under the influence of the big farmers' lobby, state governments made liberal use of these relaxations in favor of big owners of land. As a result, not much could be expected by way of surplus land under this policy. Poor records and inefficient administration. It is equally true, though not applicable to all the states, that records about land ownership are in many cases non-existent, in some defective, and in quite a few unclear. As a result, in places where honest administrators were out to implement the policy of sealing, their efforts were thwarted by the lack of proper land records. The administration too, in a quite few states, is to be blamed for failure on this front. It is not merely the incompetence that is being referred to. More importantly, it is the policy of dishonest administrators who acquired lands for themselves or helped and connived at fake transfers in favor of their relatives and friends that has blocked the implementation of the sealing policy. Unfavorable political climate. Perhaps the most important cause of inadequate implementation is the lack of proper political backing to the sealing measures. In a state like Punjab, for instance, the failure of land reforms has so far been not due to the lack of tools for enforcement. Punjab has a well-established revenue administration. Besides, the record of tenancies has been maintained throughout the state for several decades. Even the tenants in this state are not that weak organizationally as in other states. Yet even in such states, there have been failures. The only valid explanation is the lack of political support. The political parties in some states are susceptible to big farmers' pressure. Besides, by and large, the tenants, because of their poverty and illiteracy, are not well organized as to provide a countervailing power. In this connection, the Task Force on Agrarian Relations in its report has rightly pointed out that in a society where laws, administrative conventions and the traditions are pro-private property, it is not possible to succeed in the implementation of laws made for and separately applicable to rural areas. Suggested remedies. Since the progress under the ceiling policy has been little, it is necessary to undertake measures to make it a success. For this, four types of measures are needed. First, measures should be devised for the fuller implementation of the existing laws. This requires steps along the following three lines. 1. The land records needs to be updated so that the maximum land under the existing laws can be declared surplus. Similarly, registration of land for the new owners, that is, those who come in possession of distributed land, be made simple and less time-consuming. 2. The existing laws be suitably amended to plug loopholes and to ensure that the lands declared surplus are compulsorily taken hold of by the government. The same is also needed for the many cases pending with the courts. 3. It is important to tighten the administrative machinery for implementation by laying down proper and well-defined procedures, fixing of responsibility, and recruitment of suitable personnel. Second, measures are needed to increase the size of land that can be declared surplus and acquired for distribution. In this regard, two suggestions can be made. 1. The existing ceiling law should be made applicable with retrospective effect. This would also undo the fake transfers. 2. The upper limit of ceiling on land be reduced so that more surplus becomes available. This is feasible too. In the 1960s and in the early 1970s, when ceiling limits were fixed, there was little technological advance in agriculture. However, since then much advance has taken place so that a smaller size of land can be good or profitable proposition for the owner. Hence, it is desirable to lower the limit of land that the owner can hold. Third remedy would be a set of measures concerns the improvement in the environment for making the ceiling policy a success. The important requirements in this connection are the following. 1. And the most essential is the need to mobilize and organize the poor and create or generate awareness among them about the relevant laws and procedures. 2. The village level functionary be made accountable for the implementation of the policy. 3. There is a need for evolving a system of monitoring the progress and for continuing evaluation instead of evaluation after the event or after certain fixed period, so that hurdles are removed and difficulties resolved as and when they arise. 4. The cooperation of voluntary agencies be actively sought for the implementation of ceiling laws and distribution of the surplus lands. 4. The steps necessary for the success of the ceiling policy should also be such as raise the efficiency of the small farmers, in particular of the former landless laborers who get land under this policy. For this, they need various sorts of help. One such important help is financial assistance, as these farmers are very poor. The scheme of financial help for these people should be such as it should enable them to take the profitable cultivation. 2. It is also necessary that activities of these beneficiaries be linked with the other rural programs like the Integrated Rural Development Program, Jawahar Rozgar Yojana, etc., so that they can get the much needed inputs and other facilities. 3. The assignees of land be encouraged to form cooperatives for farming, marketing, etc. The suggested measures will not only help in implementing the policy, but equally importantly, these will make the beneficiaries viable farmers. Consolidation of holdings. This is the third point. This component of land reforms concerns the consolidation of small and scattered pieces of land into compact units. The importance of this land policy lies in the fact that a big bulk of holdings in the country consist of very small sized lands which are also fragmented and as such lie scattered at different places. Extent of subdivision and fragmentation. There are two aspects of the problem of small holdings. First is that many holdings are small in size. The second is that many owners have small pieces of plots which are widely scattered so that it becomes physically very difficult to cultivate them together in an efficient manner. The former happens when big holdings are cut up into small ones called subdivision of farms. The second, known as fragmentation of holdings, takes place when each owner has small pieces of plots located in different places. Small sized holdings. The size of an overwhelming number of holdings is very small indeed. This fact is so dominating that Indian agriculture can as well be picturized as dotted by tiny sized and inefficiently operated lands. This is amply revealed by the 1990 and 91 data on operational holdings. According to it, as many as 59% of the holdings are marginal in size with land up to 1 hectare. The area under them is small at 14.9% of the land under cultivation. Another 19% of the total holdings are small with land from 1 to 2 hectares. These have under them 17.3% of the total cultivated land. Together, these holdings, marginal and small, constitute a very big proportion of 78% of the total holdings in the country. The land under them is just 32% of the total cultivated land. Scattered holdings. According to the 8th round of the National Sample Survey, an operational holding on an average is divided into 5 units. Further, it has been found that as the size of holding increases, the number of units per holding rises. Harmful consequences. Subdivision and fragmentation of holdings have resulted in many grave consequences. Below are listed the major ones. Wastage of land. Quite a sizable part of land under cultivation gets wasted, largely on two counts. In the first place, because of the large number of farms, a considerable area of land is used up for boundaries, hedges, and pathways. According to one estimate in Punjab, 16% of land is wasted in drawing boundaries and hedges. Secondly, those lands which shrink into very tiny sizes no longer remain adequate for cultivation. In Ratnagar district, there are small farms of the size of 0.06 acre. It has been estimated that in Punjab, 6% of land is split up into such small units that it is very difficult to put them under cultivation. Such lands are a clear wastage from the viewpoint of agricultural production. Rise in cost. The cost of agricultural operations also increases on account of two factors. In the first place, there is the rise in certain fixed costs. With the size of farm going down, the cost of maintaining family, bullocks and implements does not fall. They remain as before, raising the average cost of output. Again, with the increase in the number of farms, there is further expense involved in fencing. In case fencing is not done, being too expensive for poor farmers, the cost goes up because of the easy entry of animals into such farms, destroying the produce. Secondly, even the current cost go up, the purchase of seeds, fertilizers, etc. is made in small quantities, and since these have to be bought from the retailer, these involve higher prices. The transport of fertilizers and produce in respect of a large number of farms involves large expenses than when the number of farms is small. Similarly, the increase in the frequency of visits to scattered farms amounts to wastage of labor and is equivalent to rise in labor cost. Third harmful consequence is hinders progressive farming. Under these conditions, it becomes almost impossible to make permanent improvements like digging of wells and water channels, construction of storage facilities for harvested crops, etc. Nor it is possible to use machines and or adopt modern farming practices. This is so for three reasons. One, small farmers do not command adequate resources for these improvements. Two, the making of such changes and the use of modern implements become costly. 3. The application of these requires a minimum size of land, and in case of the holding is below the minimum size, it is not possible to make use of them. Underutilization of labor and capital. The available labor and capital on such small farms fail to be fully utilized. The underutilized takes two forms. In the first place, for want of adequate volume of work, the entire labor force and such capital as bullocks, etc., do not get work to their full capacity. Secondly, even those who are seemingly engaged in work are not properly utilized. A farmer, for instance, may look very busy in moving from farm to farm, carrying fertilizers, etc., but this is not a proper use of his labor. Fourth consequence is difficulty in supervision. In view of the fact that pieces of land are small and scattered, it is not possible for the farmer to be near all the units of cultivation at the same time. As a result, he is not able to look after and keep a close watch on his lands. Sometimes he is not able to perform necessary operations on all the pieces as per needs. All this leads to low yields. Disputes and litigation. Often disputes, sometimes involving law courts, arise on account of fencing, making of pathways, moving through one another's farm, etc. These result in wastage of time and money.